50 and 10.
Just the two things.
Oh, I think it'll do it. It's pretty unique. It's got the barb.
The doors to an estate sale just opened at a split-level house in Overland Park. People had been waiting in line for what was billed as a sweet vintage home on estatesales.net. And the house delivered on that promise. It's full of wood paneling, brown flowery wallpaper, and shag rugs. Our producer, Sylvia, caught some of the first purchases of the day.
This is just an old 1970s Curtis Gear mid-century wall hanging. It's a brother and his brother-in-law, and they made these brutalist cut metal wall art pieces. And they're just fun and easy to sell, so I buy them.
Mug and some stir sticks. She collects them.
I came for the jewelry that sold as soon as somebody, the store opened, the show opened.
Are you bummed?
Yeah. That's why I came here. I made a special effort.
Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's show is all about the crazy and wonderful world of garage sales, estate sales, yard sales, and even flea markets. If thrifting plays a special role in your life, we hope you'll call in and tell us what you think that's all about. The number to call is 816-235-2888. In the studio, I'm joined by Jennifer Field. We've known each other for a long time. She's an artist here in town, and she runs an estate sale business. She's been at it for a long time, and she knows everyone and everything related to what she calls junkin'. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Gina.
Why do you call it junkin'?
Well, I certainly didn't come up with that term. That's a popular term for the whole art of going out and finding trash and finding treasures and making treasures out of other people's trash.
Treasures out of trash. Well, how did you get into it?
I was raised by a black woman who was the sole, well, not sole, but a breadwinner for a huge family. And in high school and grade school even, she took me on her runs with her, and she taught me how to go about getting a bargain and finding what you need for a fraction of what you would normally pay.
Do you think that, I mean, it sounds like that she brought you into a community other than maybe the one that you came from. And I'm wondering if different communities have different roles within them for garage sales, estate sales, yard sales.
Oh, that's a loaded question for me. Yeah, I think that would be true for sure, you know. There's a lot of subcultures within the resale world, and some people are doing it for fun. Some people are doing it for economic reasons because stores are too expensive. Some people are doing it because they have a knowledge of antiques and want to spread that around. And each within the larger world of reselling things, there are tons of different communities, and it's kind of fun how they interact. And it's also not a respecter of class in the way a lot of businesses are, you know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I hadn't thought about it before right this minute, but I guess what I mean is that, you know, you encounter everyone from the full spectrum of economic situation in the country.
What is the difference between, say, antiques or fine vintage wear and junk?
Can I laugh on air?
Yeah.
That's a funny question. One person's trash is another person's treasure, Gina. So the first thing to know is that a fine antique, the sentimental value that people attach to things actually has a lot to do with the real value of the item. So there's that, and that could be a junky thing to a fabulous, you know, amazing European, super expensive antique. The value isn't determined by the item. It's determined by the person who owns it and their relationship to it. That being said, junk is thought of sort of more like everyday items, household stuff you use, things that don't have high value on the resale market. And fine antiques are more considered things on the higher end of cost. Maybe things that are traded in auctions rather than garage sales or in stores or places that you have to have a more specialized outlet to sell them in order to get their proper price.
What is the difference between a yard sale, a garage sale, and an estate sale? Can you explain these three terms?
Well, a yard sale's in a yard, usually. A garage sale's in a driveway, and or a garage. And an estate sale really is supposedly in an entire house. It's the sale of an estate. Either someone's died or they've moved and left a considerable amount of stuff, and the whole house will be open. There's a bad etiquette that people occasionally do where they label their garage and yard sales estate sales and make you drive miles over there to find them, and then here it's a yard sale, and that's so not people, very cool.
Yeah, there are people then who specifically seek out estate sales. Why?
Estate sales have many more items. It's a full house, and it goes from, you know, cleaning supplies all the way up to furniture, clothes, everything. There's more to choose from, but the cost is usually a little higher. Garage sales are much cheaper, yard sales much cheaper.
What are some of your general observations about the culture around all this stuff in Kansas City, whether it's the quality of stuff for sale, the lay of the land, the customs and etiquette of shoppers and sellers?
Well, we're experiencing a huge boom here in Kansas City in a way because of the blossoming of the West Bottoms flea markets. We've always had a really good flea market culture in Kansas City. The 63rd Street Drive-In, the Boulevard Drive-In are open year-round, which is unusual. A lot of cities have much more sporadic monthly flea markets, but we have weekly flea markets almost all year, which is great.
And year-round, that's surprising because we have very cold winters.
I know, and it thins way down in the winter, but there's some hardcore people that are out there all year long, and maybe not in the snow, but the rest of the year, and that I lost my train of thought there.
That's okay. You know, let's get some perspective from another guest. I'd like to bring Gretchen Herman in on this discussion. She's a retired librarian and anthropologist who has written extensively on culture and behavior at these kinds of sales in the United States. Welcome to Central Standard, Gretchen.
Thank you very much.
What inspired you to study garage sales?
A common question. I was traveling on a country road between Ithaca, New York, and Binghamton, where I was doing my PhD work, and I saw a shelf with some items on it, and it said sale. There was nobody actually there with it, but I was thinking, my goodness, you take a different lens for anthropology, and you go, what is this, some monument to consumer culture? So I started investigating garage sales, and it worked into a dissertation and then many other smaller studies and journal articles.
Do you think it is a monument to consumer culture?
In a way it is, because it has to do with one of the articles I still have to write, the fact that we have everybody suffers from what TMS, which is too much stuff. And they're always trying to figure out what they need, what they don't need, what they can live with and live without. And there's a lot of push against the notion of clutter these days. So very often they're trying to get rid of things, and garage sales are a major way to do it. But very often people then immediately get more stuff as soon as they get rid of it.
So you had people fill out questionnaires about their behavior around garage sales, and you also accompanied a lot of people to garage sales.
Yes.
And interviewed them. Tell me about that experience of really getting very intimate with people's little foibles around garage sales or strategies or just emotional attachment to these things.
Well, there is a lot of emotion that comes in with the items. You can see some people are seeking something special, and when they find it, they get very excited. And then that item can be, you know, particularly special for them. They do show and tell with others. One of the things that can be particularly exciting for them is getting something at a really low price. And Jennifer, I think, was actually very astute in terms of her notion of the breadth of class and styles of people who go to sales. It is one of the places where you rub shoulders with people of different backgrounds from yourself. And then people go for different kinds of things. Garage sales offer the ability of people to not only get things inexpensively, but also to reduce the price through bargaining. That's an attraction for many people in terms of the garage sale experience. So people will usually set their prices with the notion that to allow a little bargaining to happen. And yet there is a very truncated style of bargaining in the United States for the garage sale as compared to other cultures. In many other cultures, right.
I want to jump in because part of what you write about is that the haggling for prices and deals that goes on at the garage sale or estate sale really exists outside the model of mainstream economic activity in the West, that in the United States anyway, we're usually distrustful of transactions that involve too much negotiation over price. I mean, the term used car salesman conversationally can be synonymous with swindler for a lot of people. So what's the difference between haggling at a garage sale and negotiating a price for a used car? I mean, in our culture.
Well, the scale is huge. We actually do have it as a convention to haggle over prices for certain expensive items, such as rugs or used cars, as you're saying, although it is not trusted. As you said, you never quite trust the people who sell these things. However, in garage sales, it's one of the few places, and flea markets, as you say, where you can haggle over low to moderately priced goods. And it certainly is accepted, but it's not universally accepted, so that some people will get upset when you try to bargain, especially early in the sale.
Why?
When a seller has, like, the first hour, actually more like the first half hour, because people come usually early for a sale, and sales usually start prior to their stated starting time, so that people will end up, they'll lose their opportunity to get the best price for something at the beginning of a sale. If they just say, go to half price right then, they may have lost an opportunity because the next person that comes along will buy it for full price. Later in the sale, presumably people have already picked it over and have decided they don't necessarily want things as much. And then you're likely to get much more robust bargains and bargaining going on with that. The other thing is, the items for sale are generally somebody's possessions, and they may or may not be attached to them, but in any case, it's also at their home. And this is a huge thing about garage sales that happens, that really is the key to the interest in them, is you have used goods by the seller selling them from their home.
So you get that personal insight into the life of this object.
You get the personal insight, but there's also a sense of attachment that the sellers still have. So it's not a good idea to go to somebody's garage sale and say, oh my God, that lamp is disgusting. It's so green. You know, that just wouldn't, you know, that would be impolite. So you have both notions of and behavior ethos of commerce, and you also have guest host relations too. So
I want to see if any of this stuff sounds like it is, if it resonates with Jennifer.
Sure.
I think that is a thoughtful summary of certain things. It does. The difference to me really is you're talking about operating in a cash economy. When you're talking about stores or antique malls, even certain, you know, flea markets of the West Bottoms variety versus established antique malls or stores, they take credit cards, it's a whole thing. But when you have a cash economy, there's a lot more room to barter. Mm-hmm. And part of why bartering isn't a big part of the United States is we've long been encouraged away from a cash economy into a credit situation. And so there's not a lot of bartering possible there. And so I think an important thing about this, and it's kind of interesting to me, the blossoming of the West Bottoms, say, here in town, our big flea market world, I think a lot of it comes as a response to the credit crunch of the 80s. I mean, trash culture really took off in the 90s with the blossoming of all the TV shows. And I think the credit crunch, people realized, hey, we can't continue to max up our credit cards. And buying less expensive goods with cash is one way to avoid that trap of massive debt.
Well, I think that's really interesting from the seller's, from both the buyer's and the seller's standpoint. I mean, in like a store where prices are set. One of the things that's also true is that part of what's happening is that a manufacturer needs to recoup certain costs associated with manufacturing an object.
The footprint is bigger.
Right. And the seller needs to pay for the rent on the storefront and all that stuff. There's a different situation at a yard sale or garage sale or estate sale where, sure, someone has spent money on something at some point in the past, but presumably they've gotten the use out of it. And this is kind of a bonus, unless, say, people could be having a sale to pay for medical bills or to help with some other crisis. Gretchen, what do you think about that aspect of what's going on at the sale?
I agree with you entirely that is what tends to happen, because you do not have the infrastructure, and the value, potential value of items is incredibly fluid in a garage sale. You know, some people will charge 5 cents for a book. Other people will charge $5. And, you know, the value to the individual shopper may be somewhere in between. It really depends. They don't have the infrastructure that you said. And so it makes things much easier. And I also agree about the cash economy. It is largely a cash economy with regard to that. What is different, even in a flea market, for example, is that you have a certain amount of infrastructure costs with that, because to enter and however they charge people with that sort of thing. And it's also a bunch of sellers all together in an arena where you can go from one to the next. People go from one garage sale to the next, but there usually is space intervals in between, and so that they're not necessarily playing one garage sale off against another.
Talk to me about gender in garage sales, Gretchen. This is one of the really fascinating insights in your study, is that gender kind of plays out in certain ways in these environments.
Yeah, there's a lot about gender. In fact, in some ways, what I did was, focus on women. The garage sale comes from the home, traditionally women's domain. Two-thirds of the shoppers and sellers tend to be women. And so it makes an arena of economic activity that's colored by so-called, if you will, women's values. Things like nurturing others, care for presentation and cleanliness, things of that nature. It just means what you have in the household, what you keep in the household, what you decide to sell, things of that nature tend to be women's work.
But what about within the bargaining piece of it?
With regard to bargaining, too, there is a gender idea where men in general bargain more, even for salaries, for example. There's plenty of literature talking about how men can negotiate higher salaries. It's one of the disadvantages women have in the marketplace, that they tend not to know how to bargain or feel comfortable doing it. Well, in garage sales, men tend to bargain earlier in the sale and more aggressively, which may or may not be accepted by the seller. It really depends on the individual. And women will bargain, but they tend to do it later on, and they often look for something like an imperfection in the item for sale or something like that. And they tend to bargain in a more soft style. In all fairness, most Americans don't like aggressive bargaining. They don't want people, you know, say, oh, I'll just give you this for that, you know, that kind of thing. Instead, if you do something like, will you take a little less for this, or I've got five items and they come to $32, how about 30? You know, things like that. People will often accept that. It's softer.
Jennifer, have you observed at estate sales and yard sales, resale in general, types of hagglers?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, there's a level of people who know what things actually are worth on the market in this city. And that's something also that's important to realize, is there's no set value for any item ever. It depends geographically where you are. It depends on the market forces in the place that the item is residing. It depends on...
By place, do you mean like neighborhood or
like
the
I could
city?
Be selling, you know, a Roseville vase here in Kansas City and I would get a certain amount for it. I could take it out to Los Angeles or New York and get more for it because there's a more active antique market there. I could take it to a little tiny town where nobody cares. That isn't entirely true, actually. People collect Roseville in the country probably more than in the cities. But, you know, things are, it's amazing how much geography plays a role in the price of something.
Gretchen, how much does geography play a role in styles of bargaining? I mean, are there regional differences? I was enjoying in your writing this example of a Southern woman who was always careful to compliment an item before trying to negotiate, saying something like, "This is a beautiful teapot, but did you notice that it's chipped?"
Right. I do think that there probably is. I haven't examined that per se, but it is definitely a good example of the softer bargaining style because you are dealing with people's possessions. And if you basically say, "Oh, that's really dirty," or something, you know, sort of like, it's chipped. It's not worth that. It's only worth 50 cents." If you do it like that, people are not necessarily going to want to agree with you, they could feel insulted.
You asked me about haggling, and I get so many things going in 1 minute. I think, whoop, my train derails so easily. But there, people that haggle, you know, there is polite haggling and impolite haggling. And men in general, your gender question was interesting because men really prefer a bargain. Men will almost always haggle is my experience. And I started to say men are bigger cheapskates, but that isn't entirely a very nice way to put it. But I think they certainly appreciate the value of a dollar. I'll give them that. There's a gender stereotype there that seems a little more accurate. Women will pay more for an item than a man will because I think men are somehow slightly more frugal. But when people are rude in haggling, that doesn't ever do you any good. And really, it's not even haggling. You just say, "Look, will you take less?" And they either say yes or no, and then you're done. If you harass them, you're not going to get anywhere.
Well, yeah. Can you flesh out the difference between polite and rude haggling?
Maybe ask
Gretchen.
Right. Okay. Being, first of all, many men, and I'll pick up from what Jennifer was saying, many men feel they have to bargain and like to bargain for sport. It's really just, it's the sport of it. It's the fact that they can get some price lowered.
You call this
even
the
more
chutzpah
than the item.
Haggler.
Right, right. There's a lot of chutzpah.
It's a power thing, too, I think.
Absolutely power. And there are often male dealers who will come in and say, even early on in the sale, that table, chair, and lamp, I'll take that. There are combined would be $100, and they'll say $50, right? And just say, "I will take it for that," and not even talk to the seller about it. That would be considered rude and is often highly aggressive. People do not appreciate that sort of behavior. So long as you recognize that, respect the people who are selling and try to negotiate on the merits of things, which may just be that the price is too high for you.
Central Standard will be getting right back to this conversation about garage sales, yard sales, and estate sales. If you think Kansas City has its own rules, systems, and strategies, call 816-235-2888. Share your pointers and observations and what the garage sale economy means to you. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a sec. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with estate sale professional Jennifer Field and anthropologist Gretchen Herman. Today, we're all about the bargains in your front yard. We're talking about garage sales and estate sales and Kansas City's particular culture around these rituals. Call 816-235-2888 with your sales strategies, your observations, and maybe a story that gets to the heart of what garage sales really mean. Let's hear what they mean to Congressman and former Kansas City Mayor Emanuel Cleaver. Sylvia Maria Gross spoke with him 10 years ago when he was running for Congress. She asked what he liked to do in his spare time.
I like to go to thrift stores. I like to find bargains. On Saturdays, I like to hang out at a place called Shop and Swap on 63rd Street. I can roam down aisles and aisles of junk, and it is just delicious. And then going in and out of thrift stores, I used to have thrift store buddies who would call and say, you need to get out to the thrift store on Blue Ridge. They've got some new stuff in.
Jennifer Field, what do you hear in this? I hear a reference to thrift store buddies. I mean, do people hit sales in groups?
I love that. They do. I think they do. Also, Kansas City thrift store scene is a really amazing thing of its own. It's its own animal. In the 80s, it was fantastic. In early 90s, 70s.
What do you mean by fantastic?
I mean, the thing about to realize is that every generation, you know, items in a house have about a 30 or 40 year span, as it were. You know, people sort of make all their money in their 20s and 30s. They buy their stuff. And then for years in the past, they would keep that. So about every 30 or 40 years, you'd have, you know, like now we're having mid-century modern 70s. When I started out junking in the 80s, I was big on buying antique clawfoot, bark cloth, sofas and chair sets from the 40s because all this stuff from the 40s was being released onto the market.
And was that because of the generation that was dying? I mean,
yes,
that might sound crass,
that's but... that's exactly what it's about. And so the thrift stores in Kansas City were packed, and pickers came from all over to shop the thrift stores here. What's happened through the years since then is that thrift stores themselves have become a lot more corporatized, and say Goodwill, Salvation Army, DAV, a lot of the big thrift stores now cull their better items and sell them abroad or sell them on the internet for higher dollar. And so thrift stores are a lot more depleted than they used to be. And so thrift stores in Kansas City are still great. There's still lots of them, but they're not the just amazing paradise they were 20 years ago.
When Emmanuel Cleaver describes walking down aisles of junk and finding that, as he puts it, delicious, do you know the feeling that he's describing, and can you tell us about it?
Oh yeah, they say that there's a certain neurological mindset or brain wiring that goes with junking and thrifting, and that is, you know, you sort of leave the house. Often people who suffer from depression end up as junkers, as it turns out, or addiction issues. But because when you find the thing, your brain lights up. There it is. Ah. And a lot of it also, I've read studies that people who it's almost like the lottery or like gambling. It gives you a sense of hope. You go out of the house in the morning and maybe the rest of your life is totally gone to hell, but you think, oh, today might be the day I find something at this garage sale, and it inspires a constant stream of hope in people.
Gretchen, is this something that you encountered in your studies and in your extensive interviews and discussions with people who do this a lot?
Yes, certainly. I'm not sure that people have said that overtly so much, but it's very clear in their behavior and the excitement over certain things if they find it, the sadness if they miss out on something, somebody else got something first, and they felt upset. Often there's an obsession like, oh, damn, I should have bargained more on that, or I should have... done something else to get a hold of something, or someone may feel that they have
Gretchen?
Yes?
Well, I want to jump in and tell you, I have a confession about my own background with sales and things. I grew up with kind of a grandmother figure who was obsessed with sales. We called her EB and we adored her. And she grew up as an orphan, actually, in Kansas City during the Great Depression. And I really think that she had just this super scrappy and super frugal side to her that she could let out in full force in these settings later in her life where things had become more comfortable. But she still had this side of her. And as I got older and had my own apartment to decorate and furnish, I lived in the 39th Street area, and the sales in the front yards over there really helped me out to, like, get my space set up. But no matter how good a deal I thought I got, I'd go to EB and I'd say, I got this thing for a dollar, and she was totally unimpressed, especially if that's what they were asking for it, if I had not bargained down, and specifically if I had not bargained down to 50% of what they were asking. So if they were asking a dollar, I should have paid 50 cents. And since she's been gone, my sole purpose in going to sales is to practice the tricks she taught me. But I think that that makes me a chutzpah negotiator. I mean, I'd give you another term. shocked and horrified at my own haggling. What do you think is going on there, Gretchen?
You're embracing the style of somebody that you respected and who helped nurture you, and you're doing it for her.
I think that's definitely true. What's weird is that I avoid bargaining in every single other situation, because my idea is that if I pay less, someone else earns less, and that's a really uncomfortable notion for me. I mean, even just traveling to countries where haggling is the norm, I'm still reluctant, because the difference in price generally means less to me, or so I perceive, than it does to the person selling an object.
Yes,
why the different attitude?
Well, because you perceive people in a foreign country, and usually when you're doing tourist things, you don't necessarily have the wealthiest of people who are on the street selling things, and you want to help them. So that's one way for a little bit of money to change hands for them, you know, if you pay a higher price. The difficulty with the notion of negotiating price is that at a certain point it is a zero-sum game. And, you know, if somebody wins, somebody loses. So you try to find that sweet spot where both people win as much as possible.
Jennifer, this idea that, I mean, we don't really know why someone's having a sale. And as someone who facilitates sales for other people, would I be surprised to find out some of the reasons behind people having sales in the first place?
I don't, you know, it's pretty basic. Either someone's died, or they're in economic need, or they just have too much stuff and their family has harassed them to get some of it out, to be honest. I'm not sure it's, you know, I think it falls into one of those basic categories. Or you might get someone who has really cool stuff and they are happy to show it off and put it out there, which I've seen that, you know, too. I think we're hunter-gatherers, you know, we are hunter-gatherers as mammals. It's a pretty primal instinct in us, or some of us anyway, you know.
To change gears just a little bit, Jennifer, has the explosion of vintage and antique markets in the West Bottoms changed the lay of the land here in Kansas City beyond just that district? I mean, has it changed the whole dynamic in any way?
Oh, yeah, big time. I think really you have to, even before that, go back to the rise of television shows. You cannot underestimate. And antiques, roadshow, and, you know, we've had 10 years now or more, maybe 15 years of solid, endless television programming about how great it is to buy old stuff and redo it. And we also have a new sort of do-it-yourself ethic that's also come across through TVs. I mean, there's endless. We used to have This Old House at Antiques Roadshow, and that's it. Now we have like 50 shows or more. We have whole television channels devoted to fixing up an old table, you know. And also the shabby chic trend, which was very handy to the resale market. Shabby chic came along, and all of a sudden everybody could take any old beat-up dresser they found on the curb, smack some paint on it, hit it with the hammer, say it's distressed, and sell it for $100. And you can't underestimate that, those larger cultural trends, and then also the stock market downgrade and the economic crash of sorts, and the West Bottoms grew out of all of that, you know. And it's made shopping in Kansas City a little more difficult. I mean, garage sales are picked over faster, estate sales picked over faster. It's a little more competitive. It's always been very competitive in the antique fine. Kansas City doesn't have a lot of high-end antiques or fine antiques, and the people who buy and sell them were traditionally a very small group of people who were pretty aggressive because they had to be. The super highest end of good antiques in Kansas City get sent to auction, either auctions here in Kansas City, either Dirk Soulis or Rick Pence, who run the two biggest auctions in the city, or Turner down on Gwinnett in the Bottoms, or Blue Ridge Auctions, been around a long time. There's a lot of different levels of auction houses, and high-end stuff goes to auction. That middle range of stuff and then the low-end range of stuff often end up in the West Bottoms. And that you know, so it's harder to find the, you know, you have to work a little harder to find low level stuff. That being said, not everybody wants to go to garage sales. A lot of people find flea markets and garage sales distasteful, so they can now go to the West Bottoms where it's more like a store environment and buy their thing. Not much haggling goes on down there, very little, but It's been a good thing for the Kansas City resale trade, and also not such a great thing if you're at the bottom of the heap.
Are collectors, you mentioned people who are collect and sell high-end things. Are collectors a special kind of sale-goer?
I think so. I mean, in a way, the best collectors in Kansas City all maintain relationships with the estate sale people, and they are able to say, you know, if you collect guns, and that's also a very gender thing. It's interesting. Men collect certain things, women collect certain things, and there's a big difference often. But the high-end collectors of certain things maintain good relationships with people who sell their type of stuff, auction houses and estate companies, and so they maintain pipelines to what they collect, which is something the average garage sale stopper buyer doesn't necessarily do.
Well, at an estate sale we visited at Overland Park, we met a guy named Chen Zhao. He's Chinese, and he goes to sales with his wife, his daughter, his grandmother, and his aunt, specifically looking for what he calls Chinese stuff. Here's why he looks for items from China, not in China, but at garage sales.
Actually, there's a lot like the old Chinese stuff we can call like antique. It's like 100 years old stuff like that. And it's from American, and the Americans, those families like go to China and collect those and come back. And it's really old and antique style. So that's why we like collect those things. Yeah, and China is a lot of stuff already like fake, and it's not like real things. So we like here better.
That is amazing to me, that these Chinese antiques followed this path from China to America via collectors, then ended up in yard sales, where Chinese immigrants can buy them and, in a way, like, reclaim them.
It's interesting. I have dealers that I deal with in Turkey particularly who a lot of European and Turkish, Middle Eastern and Asian antique dealers come to the United States to buy antiques and take them back to their countries. I mean, the biggest market for those antiques is actually in their countries, and they get sent back.
Gretchen, what are you hearing in this?
I've heard something very similar, too. China had most of its valuable antiques taken to different countries, and that not only individual shoppers, such as the person you mentioned, but higher up people are actually going, not just in the United States, but trying to get a hold of their antiques that have gone throughout the world. Something similar happens with stamps as well. A collector friend of mine said that that's what has to happen, say, if you're a country in Africa and you don't have any collections of your own stamps. You have to go elsewhere to the United States or Europe to obtain them.
Let's talk to Alan in Leavenworth. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
What's your story to share with us?
I lived in Europe for 9 years, and particularly in Germany. And every Thursday, people would put out furniture and other things that they no longer need, because they do not use secondhand stores and things like that. And you were able to get complete bedroom suites to include with dressers that are marble top and things like that. Their tradition is different, but I have no idea how many Americans that served in Europe had to basically furnish their house with perfectly good pieces of furniture from Germany.
Hmm. Well, so he's talking about the traditions in Europe. Gretchen, what do you know about how the American culture around this stuff differs from or is similar to what goes on in Europe?
That usually is different. Traditionally, people in Europe have a stronger sense of privacy and boundaries than people in the United States. There's a big emphasis in American culture on friendliness and openness and, you know, stop by anytime, that kind of thing. That's not the way it is in most parts of Europe, except for various enclaves of where a lot of Americans might be or Amerophiles. And it sounds as if the area that Alan was speaking of is a place that had a lot of Americans. They don't have garage sales per se, usually, unless it's, again, highly influenced by American culture.
You can finish your sentence.
Okay. What you get is the boundaries. They have fences and walls. And in the United States, friendliness, as I said, is very important, and people will come and, you know, strangers looking over stuff in your own front yard. So it's a very different style. Australia also has a few garage sales.
Got to jump in. Central Standard's off to one more break. Why do you go to sales? Do you have a poignant story? There's still just a little time to get in on the discussion, but not much. So call now, 816-235-2888. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Jennifer Field and Gretchen Herman. Jennifer knows Kansas City's estate sales, flea markets, yard sales inside out. And Gretchen is an anthropologist who studied this whole sale world. We're taking a close look at the customs around these sales and trying to figure out what they mean. Hi again, Jennifer.
Hi.
And hello to you, Gretchen.
Hello again.
So let's talk a little bit about Kansas City specifically. Jennifer, are there rules of thumb for, like, places to find certain kinds of things, say a lot of international goods, or what kinds of stuff you would find if you go to suburbs versus city neighborhoods?
Yeah, that's a good point. Our last conversation before the break, in terms of one thing, military bases, often if you chunk in the neighborhood or vicinity of military bases, sometimes you can find a lot of really interesting international items because people bring things back from their tours and ship them back. In fact, one of the finest collections of antiques, fine antiques, in Kansas City is a woman whose father, grandfather and father were big colonels in World War I and World War II, and she has unbelievable things that he shipped back from all over the world. Also, it does seem to be a rule of thumb that if you want old things, you need to go to an old neighborhood. In general, I mean, if you're out in the suburbs and in brand new housing, yes, there will be the occasional old thing, but people tend to they might have some heirlooms or some family items, but usually you'll get new stuff in new suburbs and older stuff in older suburbs, because most people, like I said earlier, have bought things at a certain point in their life. You occasionally come across what I call a time capsule house, where nothing new has come in it in 25 years. And those are always really fun, but usually you'll only find them in the older neighborhoods.
Now, to some people, these sales are really fun, but not everyone wants to go home with a deal. Randy Kralik is the owner of Heartland Estate Sales, and he says he's not into shopping at estate sales himself.
I don't want our house to look like one of the sales we do. We collect nothing. When it's done, everything goes to a charity of the client's choice. So we take home nothing.
In American culture, I mean, does a garage sale kind of represent accumulation and excess? Or is it a remedy for that very thing? Gretchen?
Very good question. It's both. It's exactly that. It's both. Because it is one of the easy ways to deal with too much accumulation, and people often measure their success in rooms liberated, that kind of thing. And then they'll laugh and say, but tomorrow I'll probably go out to garage sales and start filling it up again. And so there is that cycle of binge and purge, so to speak, with regard to the garage sales. I also want to mention something about collecting in the garage sale. It tends to be a little less formal and specific than what Jennifer was describing, which I thought was absolutely apt for the higher end. What happens in garage sales a lot of times is collections find people. It's very typical for somebody to say, I bought a mask at a sale today, and 2 weeks ago I bought one, and maybe I'm collecting them. So, they start doing these things informally simply because things are presented to them.
I think a lot of collecting really is like power items and totems. And, you know, I think there's a lot of magical realm action that happens in buying and selling of stuff, whether on any level. You know, people buy something because it speaks to them, and how it speaks to them can be a really huge, interesting sort of multidimensional exchange. You know, you're right about that. And a lot of synchronicity and serendipity often occur when you're out hunting around.
When you get to a sale, do you kind of like, if you recognize that there's something you really want and you maybe you know the value of it, but the seller doesn't, is there a kind of dance that people do? I mean, talk to me about the dance of hitting that value and knowing the value of something.
Well, it's pretty exciting. You do a little victory dance if it's wildly underpriced and you know it. You know,
you have
I bought
to have a
$6,000 Mies van der Rohe table once for $200, and I was pretty thrilled about that. Yeah, you like to keep a poker face. And sometimes I'll tell people, especially if it's something I'm not going to buy, I will say, you know, this thing is wildly underpriced. You could get a little more. Because most people, frankly, unless you're in the business, most people don't know the value of their things. I don't actually run estate sales. I do house clean outs, liquidating and organizing. And I've done it for about 15 years. And what I find is people get too much stuff and they have absolutely no idea of the value of anything. And it's like I said earlier, it's hard to assign a value because it depends on so many factors.
Let's talk to Bonnie in North Kansas City. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello.
What's your story for us?
Well, I've been a garage saler. I'm just about 60 now, and I've been garage saling since my 20s because it was a great way to furnish your dorm room or furnish your first house. And some years back, probably more like 1996, I was at a garage sale, and I spent $25, and I bought some knickknacks for the house, and I bought a painting. And I didn't know anything about the artist and I don't know anything about painting to this day, but we had to move. And because I didn't know anything about the painting, I did not have them specially crated. When we arrived at our destination, there was a little L tear in the upper right-hand corner of the painting. And so that caused me to do some research on the artist and to figure out the value of the painting so that I could tell the insurance company. So it turned out that the painting was done by a gentleman named Alex Baptiste, and he lived in Savannah, Georgia, and he had a gallery. And I called the gallery one day, and he answered the phone, and I told him that I had one of his paintings and that it had been damaged, and I needed to know its value. And he said, well, flip it over and tell me what is written on the back of the painting. And so I gave him the dimensions and described the painting, and he said, oh, $6,000. I got so off my bed. I was sitting on the edge of the bed talking to him on the phone, and I could not believe that I had spent $25 at a garage sale and picked up a $6,000 painting. And I can assure you the two moves we made after that, that little sucker was totally crated and taken care of.
And you kept going to sales.
Yes, and he asked me, he said, well, how much did you pay for it? And I didn't have the heart to tell him that I bought it at a garage sale and someone obviously did not know what they had.
Yeah, I mean, Gretchen, as someone who studies this, is this a place where etiquette has an important place?
This is a really good question. Most often, the people who could key in on the value, as Jennifer said, are dealers or people who deal with these things more often. And it's a very sore spot for many people who sell at garage sales, because if they feel that dealers have taken advantage of them, which does happen at times and can be predatory, they will, you know, go up and down and rant and rave and dislike dealers and say all this stuff. On the other hand, if, as Jennifer said, sometimes she tells them something's wildly underpriced, I think that is the sort of fair thing to do with regard to something like that, especially people who are seemingly in need or don't necessarily know, you know, clueless in terms of the value of items.
You know, after sales, you'll sometimes see stuff out on a curb with a free sign. At what point is it determined that this stuff that you're trying to sell has no monetary value or just isn't worth any more time or energy?
when it's left over after a sale. Like today, I'm at the tail end of a house cleaning out a woman died, and the truck from Operation Breakthrough is there right now taking all the stuff that the family heirs didn't want. And they decided we want this donated to a charity. And that's an important thing to remember. There's umpteen charities everywhere all over that would love your used goods. And so if you don't want to have a sale, please remember that there's many charities and thrift stores, too, that would love your goods.
Gretchen, last thoughts on when something loses value or just has none, or is there no such thing?
It can be picked up again. Very often people will call the end of their garage sale and say, okay, these things maybe I'll put aside for another garage sale, these things not. Very often it's when people are just sick to death of them.
If you have a sale, when you're done, take your signs down and don't put them up before the sale starts. Thank you. And don't call your yard sale an estate sale.
Lots of parting words of wisdom from Jennifer Field. Jennifer, thanks so much for visiting us today.
Thank you, Gina.
And Gretchen Herman, retired librarian and anthropologist. I'm so glad you thought to study garage sales. What an interesting world. We'll have this conversation posted online for your enjoyment later today. Just go to kcur.org/centralstandard and share it with your garage sale enthusiast friends. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. You can sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, another very Kansas City kind of show. We'll be looking at how historic floods shaped the city we live in today and how changes in flood management might shape the Kansas City of the future. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We're getting extra help this week from Andrea Tudhope and Matt Hodapp. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's The Standard. Up to date is next. Don't miss it.